Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, progressive thinkers from China, Europe, Latin America and Canada will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media, new directions in world debates and international campaigns that are changing the world. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine. Many of the perspectives put forward by the powerful and passionate voices gracing our program this year have the capacity to move the world. The move may be to a better place, fundamentally shifting our attitudes toward a more sustainable life. Or the move may be a step down life's ladder, leading us to a more dangerous destiny. Whether to the left or the right, all of these views reveal other ways of thinking about the overall direction the world is turning, offering a veritable smorgasbord of ideas and developments to feed into our own lives. Today, the New Internationalist team is serving up some of this year's best. Let's start with security, the ability of people to feel free from fear of attack. It's a very important issue. The war on terror has been waged in its name. To set the scene, British slam poet Danny Chivers has just dropped into our airwaves with his assessment of risks in today's Western world.
Since September the 11th, 2001, 70 people in the UK have been killed by terrorists. In the same period, 400 people in the UK drowned in their own bathtubs and 500 people in the UK were killed whilst doing DIY. This poem is called Risk Assessment. I used to like bees. I'd watch them bumbling through the leaves and hum along with their good vibrations until I learned that they killed more people last year than the terrorists did. Now I write letters to the Daily Mail, demanding strict border controls on the entrances to hives and random police raids on patches of lavender, which makes about as much sense as our attempts at a notional national defence against a terrorist threat about as dangerous as stepping outside in the wet. Pneumonia is Britain's fifth biggest killer. I sometimes feel a kind of pride at our innocence and trust as we're all taken for a ride on the paranoia bus with the bulletproof windows firmly closed and every steel door secure, glancing at the dark-skinned people outside. Mount Snowdon kills as many people as terrorism. So let's drag it down to Belmarsh, hold it without trial for 28 days till it confesses to conspiring to undermine our British way of life. Whatever that is. More people are killed by taking the wrong pills than by terrorist attacks, which means that the money that's planned for ID cards, armed guards, putting people behind bars without charge would save more lives if spent instead on better labelled jars. You're more likely to be killed by a rare disease or win the national lottery. You're more likely to be killed by a hernia. You're more likely to be killed by your furniture. You're more likely to be done over by your lover, to meet your end at the hands of a friend. You're more likely to commit suicide yourself than be killed by the suicide of somebody else. And stress kills thousands every year. So, an ironic twist, you're more likely to be killed by the fear of terrorism than by a terrorist. So, how to explain this? Our government's obsessed. An endless war against a risk not properly assessed, for which they need broader state powers to watch you at all hours. CCTV, IED, they don't mean to intrude, but could you include an ample selection of bodily samples, longer detention, not to mention the need to obtain evidence mysteriously from overseas, but let them explain. It doesn't count as torture if somebody elsewhere is doing it for you. Same as having your phone tapped by some information vandal isn't really a scandal, because civil liberties must be balanced against the need for greater security. Surely you don't really need that jury, and with so many new offences terrorists in store, there's bound to be one or more made just for you. Even if you're only meant to create peaceful dissent against society's ills, you'll still find yourself in the line out front on a new witch hunt during open season. But it's definitely all about terror. And you'd be making a grave error, bordering on treason, to suggest that they might want these powers for any other reason. Well, I won't be gagged or tagged and numbered, won't have my genes and eyeballs plundered at my own expense for a defence that won't work against a threat that couldn't get much smaller. They won't get my photograph, my details, my age, so long as they don't log onto my Facebook page. And when they show up for me, I won't go quietly. I'll tell them to go out and fight the real enemy, because sex kills more people than terrorism. And so does pregnancy. So let's drop the terror cops and swap the thought police for the sex police. I bet they'll have much better uniforms.
I bet they do too, Danny. That was British slam poet Danny Chivers with his poem Risk Assessment. While Danny's poem contains facts and figures specific to Britain, the point he's making apply equally across the rich industrialised world. Alas, we really can't take Western world's war on terror too lightly. As Danny points out, the search for Osama bin Laden and other potential terrorists has instead turned into a war of terror, scooping up tens of thousands of so-called suspects to send to torture chambers across the globe and creating hatred and fear between Christian and Arab communities. Then there's the war in Iraq. 5 years since it fell onto our front pages, it's fallen off again. It shouldn't have, because the real news here is that, so far, it's cost the United States more than $525 billion. That's right, $525 billion. And killed far more than a million Iraqis, the very people whose freedom was supposed to be won by the war. Which begs the question, who are the terrorists that should really be feared? And one of the answers has to be our own governments. From Russia to Rangoon, throughout Africa and Afghanistan, it's government-backed military forces that are at best arresting and torturing, and at worst killing and raping their own citizens, people challenging the boundaries of their government's power. And talking about medals, as everyone seems to be in this Olympic week, it's in this category that China's Communist Party wins gold hands down. Behind the happy, smiling faces at the Olympic Games lies a one-party totalitarian government and a city where those who speak out for other political options end up in jail. People like Dr. Yong Zhongli, a Chinese national democracy advocate who in 2002 was catapulted from his home in Boston into a Chinese jail. You see, he returned to his country of birth at the invitation of labour leaders in the north and east of China who wanted his advice about building a non-violent labour movement. After being charged with illegal border crossing and espionage, he spent 5 years inside China's jails. Here's his description of the treatment and torture that he received as one of the thousands of political prisoners in jail there.
I was forced to sit straight without moving for hours a day. And I was handcuffed continuously for 15 days. And I wasn't allowed to go out for fresh air and sunshine for nearly 8 months. And the measure they used the most was psychological. You know, they may scare you by saying, oh, you would stay here forever. And sometimes they hinted that your family members are in a very bad situation. Once, for example, they hinted that my wife and my 6-year-old son had been taken into custody by them. They use measures like that to try to make you collapse.
And even though you might not have believed it, there would have been a lingering doubt in your mind that you were unable to clarify. How do you maintain strength in that situation?
Oh, it was very difficult. I almost collapsed. If you were weak, you would easily fall into the trap.
Absolutely frightening for those involved. You're now practiced in interrogation after that length of time with interrogators. As a non-violent practitioner yourself, what tips do you have for those who might find themselves in a similar situation?
Actually, I think the best strategy is to keep silence. If I had been better prepared, I would have kept silence. But according to Chinese law, you were not allowed to keep silence during the interrogation. you still could do it, but by doing that, you may face danger of being punished.
That was Dr. Yong Jun Lee, a political prisoner who spent 5 years inside China's prisons. And Inside China's Prisons is the title of the Radio New Internationalist program where you can hear more about Dr. Yong's incarceration. Talking of terror, we're hearing a lot about nuclear power at the moment, but let's not forget their kissing cousins, nuclear weapons. With just 50 of the world's 27,000 nuclear weapons having the capacity to kill an amazing 200 million people, you'd reckon that nations would be thumping their parliamentary tables and booming, "Ban those bombs completely!" After all, only 9 countries have nuclear bombs. Yet, despite active campaigns involving millions of people, 5 decades after the first nuclear bomb was dropped on Hiroshima in Japan, an international convention to ban the bomb has still not been successfully negotiated. But things are about to change, as New Internationalist co-editor Jess Wirth reported on this program in June this year.
Worrying about nuclear weapons has really dropped down people's list of things to worry about over the last couple of decades. But when I started researching it, I discovered that the countries that have got nuclear weapons already are not reducing their stockpiles. Pretty much all of them are in the process of modernising and trying to come up with new weapons that actually work better for them in the battlefield. So when I was researching, I was expecting it to be really, really depressing. There are loads of nuclear weapons all over the world, and people have been trying to ban them for 50 years, and there are more now than almost ever were. But what I actually discovered is that not just the rhetoric, but the thinking is starting to shift in key countries. In the US, an extraordinary turnaround has happened amongst some of the most influential Cold Warriors. Kissinger, Schultz, and a few others have actually published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal arguing for a world free of nuclear weapons. They're actually saying it is in the US's interest to disarm and to encourage other countries to disarm. And that's really, really extraordinary. And it's sent shockwaves through the military political establishment in the US. And it's opened up space for campaigners that wasn't there before. It doesn't mean that campaigners should be building alliances with Henry Kissinger, because clearly what he cares about is maintaining US military dominance all over the world. And the fact that North Korea has nuclear weapons is sort of getting in the way of that. But nevertheless, what it's done is it's made it possible to talk about serious nuclear disarmament in policy and government circles in a way that it just never has been before in the US. And a similar thing is happening in the UK as well. Britain keeps its nuclear weapons in Scotland at Faslane Naval Base. And Scotland got its own parliament a few years ago, and it doesn't have the right to govern foreign policy issues or international issues. So it doesn't actually control the fact that it has Britain's nuclear weapons on its soil. But last year, after a huge amount of campaigning and direct action against the Faslane Naval Base, there was a Scottish parliamentary election and the Scottish National Party got in for the first time. They were partly running on an anti-nuclear slate and saying, if we get in, we will do everything we can to get rid of the nuclear weapons that we're being forced to house. And opinion polls have shown that that actually was one of the reasons why people voted for them. And they got in with a majority of one, and have since passed a resolution saying that Scotland wants to be nuclear free, and now has a commission that is looking into the ways of getting rid of Trident from Faslane. So it's really exciting times. As I said, at the moment, the rhetoric that's coming out of governments doesn't match up to the reality, but the rhetoric's better than it's ever been before. So it feels like there's a door that's ajar, but it needs kicking in, and yes, it's only going to happen if movements rise up and come together and really, really push it.
And reading the magazine that you've just edited, which is called Dropping the Bomb, How to Ban Nukes and Save the Planet, it's clear that opposition is building around the world to nuclear weapons. What are the movements that have inspired you the most?
There are so many amazing movements around the world doing so many different things. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of inspiring organisations who are all playing their part in this what needs to be a global movement to ban nukes. A very inspiring movement is the movement against missile defence in Eastern Europe. It's a long-running American fantasy that they will be able to achieve what they call full spectrum dominance, which is military domination of the world by land, sea and air. And one of the things they think they need in order to do this is to have what they call a missile defence shield that essentially can track any nuclear missiles that might be being fired at them, intercept them and explode them before they get anywhere near the US. And if they can do that, and also be able to take out any other country's nuclear installations from a distance before they have a chance to strike, then they can rule the world. And Bush has revived this plan and has been pushing very, very hard for it to happen. But in order for it to happen, they have to have bases in Poland and the Czech Republic and the UK. And they've been trying to get this signed, sealed and delivered before the end of the Bush administration. And there's been huge public opposition in the Czech Republic and Poland. It's really winding Russia up because Russia believes that the missile defence shield is aimed at them. So Russia is saying, well, we're going to respond militarily if you do this. And people in the Czech Republic and Poland feel like it will make them much more insecure. So the Czech Republic was on the verge of signing, and two activists went on hunger strike and were on hunger strike for a really long time, I think 2 weeks. One of them had liver failure and ended up in hospital and almost died. And what's happened is lots of people around the world have started to join the hunger strike. So the two men that started it have stopped before they died, but other people have taken it up. So now there's this rolling hunger strike against missile defence and nuclear weapons. And there are people in Australia doing it, and the US and the UK and Italy, all over the world. And it could turn into a really, really huge movement.
Then there's the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Felicity Hill helped build its foundations. Who's in the driver's seat in this campaign, Felicity?
The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons was established by the folks who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, who work around the world in various countries. It's the medical professionals, the doctors, the physicians. And they launched this campaign because of the failure of the meeting of governments in 2005 to really do anything at all. And so they thought it's time for us to really bring together the voices calling for a nuclear weapons convention. Now, a nuclear weapons convention would be a bit similar to the landmines convention that bans the landmines, but also sets up the infrastructure for the dismantlement and the destruction of landmines. You know, nuclear weapons are big radioactive landmines. We've just seen the negotiation of the Cluster Munitions Treaty. Whole categories of weapons have been eliminated, but what is necessary first is the negotiation and the agreement about how that takes place.
That was Felicity Hill from the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, who was one of the first workers with the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And if you want to hear an extended interview with Felicity about the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, just go to the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, then click on Radio and go to the program called Those 27,000 Nukes in our audio archives. That was Andio from today's CD selection, Dig Dig. It's performed by Bob Brosman and Rene LaSalle, who were apparently inspired by the powerful forces of nature from two island cultures, Hawaii and La Réunion. Quite appropriate, really, as we're just about to chat about that most powerful of nature's forces, climate change. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And today we're talking about international campaigns making an entrance onto the political stage that could literally change the world. And as I've just flagged, climate change is right up there. What should the world's response be? Most policymakers and politicians are arguing amongst themselves about how much the world's temperature can rise, with a 3-degree rise tipped to cause widespread desertification, mass species extinction, and a sea level rise of some 25 metres. As debate diverts to whether decisive action needs to be taken in 2 years or four to avoid catastrophe, the shocking reality seems to be that we may not have one of the two polar ice caps during summer 5 years from now. A growing group of concerned scientists and environmental activists are pointing out too little, too late. They say the balance has already tipped, and the only debate now should be about how to bring down the globe's temperature, not by how much it can afford to go up. The stakes are enormous. The latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report highlights the huge number of people who are predicted to suffer a severe impact from climate change. The report says by 2080, it is likely that 1.1 to 3.2 billion people will be experiencing water scarcity, 200 to 600 million hunger, 2 to 7 million more per year coastal flooding. Translating this to effects, Christian Aid are estimating that a total of 1 billion people will be displaced from their homes because of climate change by 2050 unless urgent action is taken. Professor Walter Kalin is the representative of the UN Secretary General on the Human Rights of Internally Displaced Persons. His job, a very substantial job it is too, is to encourage governments and the UN to safeguard internally displaced persons' rights. Professor Kalin, broadly speaking, what are you encouraging governments to do?
When we're talking about human rights here, it's lots of things. People who have been displaced, they do not lose their human rights. So it's about safeguarding their property rights. It's about ensuring that people who have lost their documents can have them restored so they again have access to public services and so on. That's the first message. But it's certainly not sufficient because whereas climate change will cause displacement, we do have possibilities to reduce the risks. We have possibilities to adapt in the sense of mitigating the impact. And again, human rights tell governments you have a duty to protect people.
Absolutely. It must have been discouraging watching the situation in Burma after Cyclone Nargis play out. A huge amount of people internally displaced within Burma and the generals, faced with a constitutional change and a vote, decided to not let the international community in. Tens of thousands of people would have died as a consequence. When you saw that play out, Professor Kalin, what did you think should happen? Is there anything that the international community can do faced with a situation like that?
International law has one limitation. Its foundation is the consensus of governments. So if you have a country like Myanmar, Burma, that doesn't accept many of the guarantees, the rules that are more and more universally accepted, then we have a real problem. And this was exactly the case. We couldn't really force our way in, so to say, even though I don't like that military language. What really is needed in a situation like the one we just had with Cyclone Nargis is, first, governments must understand that they have to take preventive measures in order to mitigate the impact of such a disaster. That it's clear that they do happen, and that's part of the whole climate change development. We know their occurrence will increase. What about prevention? What do I mean? And again, I'm taking here my mandate, the human rights perspective, to show that the human rights really do play a role in this context. The European Court of Human Rights, March of this year, took a very, very important judgment regarding mudslides in southern Russia. Mudslides that hit a small town, and the European Court decided that Russia had violated the right to life. and obliged Russia to pay compensation to the survivors. Why? These mudslides are occurring in an area with high mountains. Rivers coming down, flowing through this small town. There had been mudslides in the past. And the experts have told the city authorities you have to do something about it. Mud retention walls that had been built were destroyed. Nobody repaired them. And even when the new season came with heightened risk, the local authorities failed to put up observation posts who could have warned the people. So there was a mudslide, not a very serious one. The authorities decided to evacuate the city. But then when things were calm for 24 hours, people started to go back. The authorities didn't stop them to go back to their houses. And then the real big mudslide hit the town and people died. The court said this is a violation of the right to life, even though, of course, the Russian authorities haven't killed anybody. Why? First, the court said the right to life is a duty to protect life. And this means that one has to take preventive measures to the extent possible. And especially when the danger is imminent, one has to evacuate people and make sure that they remain in safe places. And I think even though that's European human rights law, at the universal level, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights would look at it exactly the same way. And that's a very strong message to governments. You have to take preventive measures to mitigate the risks, the impact. And some governments have done a great job. If you look, for instance, at Bangladesh, where they too have flooding cyclones every year, hurricanes, etc., the number of people who die every year goes down one year after another, because they have set up very efficient warning systems. They have set up shelters where people from the villages can take refuge. So if you compare Bangladesh and Myanmar, the impact is so huge. Having said that, the next is the duty to provide assistance to the people, food, health, whatever it needs, because people have, again, under human rights law, a right to food, a right to health, a right to adequate shelter. And we at the UN level understand that these to entail also the duty, the obligation of governments to provide humanitarian aid efficiently, and if they can't do it, to accept offers by the international community. Second, what is really important, there are so many development activities going on everywhere. What we are advocating for from the UN side is that each and every development project should incorporate a disaster risk dimension. Whenever you build something, you should think about what would be the impact in the case of a disaster.
Indeed. We've been talking about the responses after disasters occur. I'm thinking about climate-proofing the globe. That's apparently going to cost an estimated $10 to $40 billion, which is actually a surprisingly small amount. Once again, we have a situation where the rich world may have the funds to contribute, but the poor world may not have as much funds. And that means whilst the rich world countries cause climate change, it's the poor world countries that will suffer because they haven't been able to take preventive approaches and actually bring down climate change within their region. What here can be done to rectify that injustice?
Yeah. Well, first, climate change doesn't spare anyone, so it's also the rich countries that are affected. But the impact is different. Poor countries are much more vulnerable to the impact of climate change, and it's very clear that the rich countries here do have an obligation. Climate change has been caused by the industrialized countries to a very large extent, not exclusively, but a very large extent. But then climate change as a problem affecting everyone only can be solved at the global level. There's also certain moral obligations on the side of the rich countries.
Indeed. One of the concepts that's being talked about at the moment is essentially a global fighting fund into which rich world countries who've contributed the most emissions would effectively cover for climate proofing, if you like, of poor world countries who can't afford it. What sympathy are you hearing from the developed world about a concept like that?
The more we will see in terms of negative impact of climate change, the more they must turn around. In their domestic laws, all these countries accept the principle of polluter pays. as one of the underlying principles of environmental law. As you just mentioned, it's also in their own interest to manage the negative impact. If poor countries don't have the means to prevent, to mitigate, to adapt, one of the causes will be that, not just talking about internal displacement, people displaced within their own country, but this will put a huge pressure on international migration. And again, that's not something the rich countries really like too much.
No, they certainly don't. That was Professor Walter Kalin, representative of the United Nations Secretary General on the Human Rights of Internally Displaced Persons. And if you want to hear more about this very important topic, just go to our audio archives at www.newint.org. Then click on radio and download the program called Human Tides. Professor Kalin has just been presenting compelling reasons why the rich world should pay to climate-proof the poor world. Other campaigners are attempting to stop carbon emissions at their source. Let's go now to Ecuador, the focus of an international campaign to keep its precious resources, in this case its oil, in the ground. That's right. Stop black gold from being mined and put in our cars. Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, has said that his country is prepared not to extract nearly a billion barrels of oil from Yasuni National Park, a part of the Amazon rainforest with an extraordinary but fragile ecological significance. To do this, he says, Ecuador will need to be compensated to the tune of at least $350 million per annum for the next 10 years. And he's looking to the international community to pay it. My friend and colleague, a co-editor with New Internationalist, Vanessa Baird, has just been campaigning on this very issue. This is such an exciting proposal, Vanessa. Tell us about Yasuni. What is the world being asked to support and why?
Yasuni is quite an extraordinary part of the Amazonian rainforest. It's in Ecuador. It has an extraordinary wealth of biodiversity. I mean, it's one of the areas of the world that may not have been touched by the last ice age, which has helped preserve a lot of the flora and fauna which might have disappeared elsewhere. So it has a lot of endangered species, but perhaps more significantly, it also has a lot of indigenous people, some of whom have actually chosen to be in isolation because they realise that chances are better for their survival if they keep a greater distance as possible from Western-style civilisation. It's also a part of the world where there's a lot of crude oil just beneath the surface. And the Ecuadorian government has made this proposal that in exchange for not exploiting this crude oil, it will preserve this area, but it'll need to be compensated by the international community for doing so, for the loss of oil revenues. I think it's also worth mentioning that the oil exploitation in the rainforest is extraordinarily damaging. It's much more damaging than it is in other kinds of environments. And one of the reasons for this is that the oil in this case is very low grade, very crude oil, but also it gets into the waterways. And once you have pollution in waterways, you know, it affects absolutely everything in that region because so much of it is water dependent. Also, as a large part of rainforest, I mean, we're talking about just under a million hectares here, it has a role in controlling climate. If it is exploited, that in itself, the destruction of the forest in itself will create more CO2. So it's an area that in many, many respects must be saved. The main issue for the indigenous people, as it is for all the other activist groups in the area, is the oil must stay in the ground. The compensation element, they view with a certain amount of suspicion. They say, well, yes, but where's this money going to go to? If there is compensation, is it going to be for our development? And so they're saying, well, okay, go ahead with this proposal, but much more than money, what they want is for the oil to stay in the ground, because that is what their lives depend on.
Indeed. Carlos Larrea, a professor at Andina Simón Bolívar University in Ecuador's capital, Quito, is one of Ecuador's leading economists. He's been working out the technical details of the Yasuni proposal. How can this work, Carlos? Let's talk some practicalities. We're talking about $350 million a year for 10 years. Who would pay this? Is there any kind of scheme to actually identify which countries pay what? Or is it a volunteer type of scheme or arrangement?
Yeah, we have been thinking in the creation of trust funds which will be internationally administrated, and the government will receive the interests of these trust funds.
Now, that's like the Norwegian model, isn't it?
Yeah, it's based on the Norwegian model, which seems to be a way to have a long-standing flow of funds to finance alternative ways of sustainable development in Ecuador. At the beginning, we were thinking that it would be difficult to think about such huge amounts of money. However, after some initial steps that the government and the civil society in Ecuador have negotiated, we are very optimistic. I can give you some examples of that. Last week, we received support from the German parliament. It seems that the German parliament is supporting the proposal and make an official recommendation to the German government to support it and at the same time to promote the support from other countries in Europe.
That's wonderful news. Important. Could I just ask Carlos, how much would they be prepared to pay?
Well, we didn't know yet about specific amount of money, but in the same statement from the German parliament, they mentioned the idea of a debt for conservation swap. As you know, Ecuadorian foreign debt is very high. It is up to $10 billion. So even a small fraction of it, which will be negotiated with the different countries, will be an important step to begin with.
And that's a very creative way of handling it. In other words, depending on the country and its relationship with Ecuador, you actually mould an in-kind payment.
Yeah, it will be one way to do it. We can also analyze new funds that have been recently created by some countries. In the Norwegian case, for example, the government created in December last year after the Bali conference.
That's the Climate Change Convention conference in Bali?
Yes, in December 2007, the Norwegian government proposed a fund to preserve biodiversity in tropical areas. The amount of funds is very high, so the government is interested in negotiating part of this fund in order to preserve biodiversity in developing countries. And this proposal, not only to mitigate global warming, but also to preserve biodiversity in the Yasuni National Park, which has been regarded by UNESCO and other international institutions as one of the regions with the highest biodiversity in the world.
650 bird species, I understand. Jaguars, all different kinds of monkeys.
Actually, it has been estimated that about 40% of the species in the Amazon region are present in the Yasuni National Park. That is why this kind of proposal has a very high value to reduce global warming, to preserve biodiversity, to save the planet.
As I understand it, the $350 million annual amount that's being requested from the international community is half the estimated value of the oil that could be taken out. So, I'm just wondering, Carlos, what would be stopping the Ecuador government in the future from changing its mind about this and starting to mine the oil again, say, for instance, in 20 or 30 years?
Yeah, that's a very important question. We want to have a binding international agreement, a binding international compromise from the Ecuadorian government to keep indefinitely oil reserves underground in the case of the Yasuni National Park. Once the Ecuador government signs this internationally binding agreement, it is very necessary to have supervised by an international organization such as the United Nations, so that we will have the guarantee that all the funds will be returned to donators in the case of Ecuador's decision in the future to oil export.
We've been talking in this program about how mining holds back rather than progresses a country. How do you see the Yasuni model applying to other oil in other countries, or indeed to other forms of mining in other countries?
Yes, I think this idea is fundamental if we think of an alternative ways to make the improvement of living conditions of most of the people in developing countries and the environment compatible. That means that in the same Amazonian region in Brazil, Bolivia, different countries with very important biodiversity, the model, I think, can be applicable. For example, Nigeria, there is a very, very long-standing conflict in the Niger Delta, in which we have an environmental sensitive area, we have an extremely complex social conflict, human rights of indigenous people jeopardized by the exploitation of natural resources. This model, I think, can be applied.
I'm wondering what the level of international support is so far. You've mentioned Norway, you've mentioned Germany. What other countries are coming in behind you to give you support?
We have already some important statements of support, for example, in the case of Spain. Spain's president came to Ecuador and publicly declared the support. At the same time, we received some important manifestations of interest from other countries, for example, Italy. Even we received a public declaration of support from the OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, in the last meeting, which took place in April this year, endorsed the proposal.
OPEC
all,
did?
Yeah.
Wow.
That is very important because obviously OPEC countries need to think about the need for a transition towards sustainable energy sources.
That was Carlos Larrea, a professor at Andina Simón Bolívar University in Ecuador's capital, Quito, one of Ecuador's leading economists. I'm Chris Richards, and you're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers, and podcasts around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And I'm sad to say that the Radio New Internationalist project is winding down. It's going to cease broadcasting in the next few weeks. So if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. That's where you'll also find a permanent archive of more than 80 Radio New Internationalist programs covering an incredibly diverse range of issues and people, just some of whom you're hearing from today. In June this year, humanitarian and diplomat Stephen Lewis joined our airwaves in a program called AIDS Without the Aid. Stephen is now the co-director of AIDS Free World, a new international advocacy organisation that works to promote more effective global responses to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. His work is urgent, and what he shares with us is gripping. He's an eminent international actor in HIV/AIDS diplomacy, the UN Secretary-General's special envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa from June 2001 until the end of 2006, and Deputy Executive Director of UNICEF from 1995 to 1999. So Stephen has worked with an astounding array of international issues. He's seen the very best and the very worst of the world. I began our chat by asking him why he'd chosen to concentrate on HIV/AIDS.
Actually, it flowed quite logically from my experience at UNICEF. In the late 90s, every time we wanted to reduce infant mortality rate in the most beleaguered and impoverished countries of the world, almost invariably in Africa, we found that our progress was set back, sabotaged, undermined, and decimated by the presence of the virus. The horror of what was happening on the continent comes home to one. And I've had a love affair with Africa for 4 to 5 decades now, and I felt quite deeply about what was happening and left UNICEF in order to immerse myself in combating the pandemic of AIDS.
The figures are mind-blowing. The United Nations estimate of the people living with HIV last year was over 33 million. The virus kills more adults than in all world war and conflict combined. In 2007, 2.1 million people. I'm wondering what you think of the way in which the rich world has almost dropped HIV/AIDS off its media agenda. If the World Health Organization is saying that the HIV/AIDS pandemic has nothing to do with heterosexual sex outside of Africa, is it one more reason why the rich world media will not give attention to HIV that it deserves?
Well, that's an interesting observation. I don't think WHO is saying that it has nothing to do with heterosexual transmission. I think they're saying that it is more narrowly concentrated, that the transmission more generally is within the high-risk groups, and that's where the focus should be. I think the rich world, quote-unquote, has become somewhat detached, partly because AIDS is now seen as a chronic disease in the rich world, and because so many more people have access to antiretroviral drugs, they can take the drugs and remain alive and function well and go back to work. And we have seen the numbers creeping up in the United States, in Canada, in Japan, in the United Kingdom. And that's largely because the high-risk groups are not behaving as responsibly as they should, lulled into a false sense of security by the antiretroviral drugs.
It's an insight into some interesting politics. But before we go any further, Stephen, let's set out some basics. Human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. What health ramifications can people who contract it expect?
Oh, the health ramifications are catastrophic. People who contract HIV find that over time it leads to AIDS. It's a whole complex of illnesses that ravage an immune system. And until antiretroviral drugs became available a few years ago, to get HIV was to face a certain death warrant. And even now, we're only treating 3 million of the roughly 10 million people who require treatment. So for them, for the other 7 million, it remains a life and death struggle. This is the worst communicable disease the world has ever confronted. And it's only in countries like Brazil, which rolled out treatment early, that they were able to contain the pandemic more intelligently than the rest of the world. At the moment, we don't have a vaccine. We've had tremendous efforts over the last 25 years and more to find a vaccine, thus far unacceptable. In other words, there is no cure. There are drugs which can contain the virus, but there is no cure.
And talking about the raft of illnesses that follow, acquired immune deficiency syndrome produces what type of conditions in human beings?
Oh, it produces every conceivable illness, from many cancers to terrible pneumonias, terrible diarrheas, which result in dehydration and death. Indeed, the greatest single killer in Africa of people who have AIDS is tuberculosis. Mm. And the co-infection rates are very high and getting higher.
Well, let's go now to Brazil, praised as having the best national HIV/AIDS program in the developing world. But its antiretroviral treatment program was controversial. Dr. André de Melo e Souza is in Rio de Janeiro. He's played a pivotal role in HIV/AIDS public policy in Brazil. Brazil was the first nation to provide anti-AIDS therapies free to patients who were prescribed it, something that was certain to dust down the dollars that big pharmaceutical companies make out of drugs. How did the drug companies react, André?
Well, obviously, initially, they were not happy at all, because Brazil may not constitute one of the major markets for HIV/AIDS drugs, but it's clearly among the 10 largest markets for these drugs, and it has become a large market, especially because the government began to implement this program you just mentioned, and thereby also started to make large purchases of these drugs. It did threaten the profitability of the companies. They were also concerned with possibilities of Brazil exporting drugs or of there being drugs smuggled from Brazil to other countries, and this would obviously impinge on their market for these drugs.
Just a bit of background here, André. What is the incidence of HIV infection in Brazil these days?
They estimate about 600,000. That was the figure of the World Bank, actually. But the figure that has actually been verified by other sources became significantly lower, I think about half as much. We have about 130,000 people on antiretroviral treatment. But obviously the number of people infected with the HIV is a lot larger than
Indeed.
That.
Indeed. The policy that Brazil adopted, which was providing free antiretrovirals for those who needed it, was surprisingly cost-effective. How so, André?
Well, to begin with, the government figured out that the cost of hospitalization was significantly superior to the cost of treatment. And this was, at the time at least, a very controversial policy. You had the World Bank, the World Health Organization, the Pan American Health Organization, the Gates Foundation, and several of the leading health research institutes. They were all saying for developing countries in general and to Brazil in particular, look, you have scarce resources and you have to apply them where they're most cost effective. And they thought prevention was most cost effective, and therefore all these resources should be channeled to prevention. And surprisingly, Brazil showed that this was not necessarily the case. At least in Brazil, treatment has been tremendously cost effective. It actually ended up saving the resources of the health ministry. Also, problems with compliance that experts predicted would arise, even increasing the resistance of the virus to treatment, were not significantly superior to the problems that had been verified in rich countries such as the United States. And so the policy proved tremendously effective. The number of people infected had been only half as much as what was predicted by the World Bank. The death rates from HIV/AIDS-related illnesses plummeted, as did those from opportunistic infections. And overall, patients began to lead a better life, economically more productive and with a higher quality.
Yet despite its cost effectiveness, many developing countries are still not prepared to challenge the big pharmaceuticals. Stephen Lewis, I'd like to bring you into the conversation now. Every day in sub-Saharan Africa alone, over 2,000 men become infected with HIV, as I understand it. When you were the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa, Stephen, what was the position of big pharmaceuticals in providing antiretrovirals to those who needed it?
Oh, big pharmaceuticals have always been reluctant to lower their prices to a level that countries could afford. And they were profoundly humiliated when they had to retreat from a court case which they launched in South Africa to prevent the South African government from lowering prices in a particular moment in time. And in fact, we wouldn't have this extraordinary run of treatment in Africa now that we do have if it weren't for the generic drugs. What happened quite specifically is that the Clinton Foundation went off to India and negotiated with a couple of major generic drug manufacturers extraordinarily low prices, much below the prices of the brand name pharmaceutical industry. And the generic compounds called triple combination therapy were absolutely bioequivalent to the brand name drug. So they were perfectly fine. They were authorized by the World Health Organization, and they're in widespread use everywhere on the continent. The big crunch for Africa now, and I suspect for Brazil and elsewhere, will be what happens when people develop resistance, because 10 or 15% of those on drugs always develop resistance over 4 or 5 years. And the second line drugs that you require, you have to change your regimen, are much more expensive. And they are at the moment brand name drugs. They're very high cost.
So how many countries across Africa are actually producing their own drugs now, drugs that are in parallel, that's just as effective, but not from the big pharmaceutical companies?
Well, it's being done in South Africa, it's being done in Uganda, and it's being looked at in Ethiopia, Zambia, Kenya, and Rwanda. They're all attempting to initiate indigenous manufacturing capacity. And they will all, I think, try to do it by way of manufacturing generic equivalents or issuing a compulsory license and getting the drugs parallel to the brand name pharmaceuticals.
So, in your opinion, Stephen, is there a softening amongst Big Pharma at the moment?
Not that I'm able to discern, but I'm not a friend of Big Pharma. I consider their behavior to be outrageous and criminally delinquent over the years. And it is true that at the moment, they are perhaps a little better than they were. And certainly there are a number of examples where Big Pharma does excellent things in Africa. You know, Pfizer has a training program in Uganda, and Merck has a remarkable collaboration with Gates in Botswana. They all try to cleanse their consciences by various initiatives. But frankly, there has not yet been an overwhelming willingness to reduce their prices dramatically and to allow for the production of generic equivalents. And indeed, some of the companies, like Abbott in Thailand, have behaved most badly. And I'm swamped in skepticism.
That was Stephen Lewis, the co-director of AIDS Free World, with the last word in a program full of very talented guests. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD selection is Dig Dig, performed by Bob Brosman and Renee LaSalle, showcasing the African, Asian and Indian influence on the island of La Réunion, a volcanic island 600 miles east of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean. It's a passionate, joyous, sexy and rhythmic romp, one of this program's favourite CDs, and includes the theme song that you're just about to hear. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And podcasters, if you want to subscribe to the last couple of programs, the New Internationalist website is where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producers are Rachel Maher and Eleanor McInerney. I'm Chris Richards. Let's chat again next week.